This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Recent events in Houston, Texas have heightened local reactions to the proposed war on Iraq. At a Houston area high school, 7th Congressional District of Texas Representative John Culberson deflected criticism at a town hall meeting about his vote to abdicate congressional war powers to George Bush. While in other areas of Houston, groups like Not in Our Name have been active in opening up dialogue with Texans concerned with what they perceive as irresponsible decision-making on the part of government officials, such as Representative Culberson. From KPFT in Houston, Jackson Allers and Barry Brosa show the contrasting opinions of a Texas congressional representative in the face of an increasingly anti-war sentiment being voiced by his constituents.
Although the pro-war sentiment is alive and well in Houston, Texas, there are a growing number of rational voices showing up to local town hall meetings to challenge the war. Significant is the fact that they are challenging their congressional representatives after George W. Bush already has the authority to attack Iraq. People in Houston are asking for accountability. In line with this, the Houston Not in Our Name chapter recently held a benefit to strengthen the efforts of those who support peace. The following audio is taken from both Culberson's town hall meeting and the Not in Our Name benefit. Music included here from the event is by the Free Radicals. Spokespersons represented come from Honore Brown of the Not in Our Name Houston chapter, Congressman Culberson, and Donald Tatum, a Houston native that has seen 5 U.S. wars in his lifetime.
When I say not in our name, I mean no longer in the name of American people am I going to stand idly by while the government that's supposed to serve our needs as a community, as a society, to use our name to promote their own selfish, you know, corporate agendas, whatever agendas the government have that isn't about promoting the needs and the will of American people. The government doesn't show enough initiative to include the American people's and American people's opinions on this. I mean, lots of people emailed their congressmen and their senators telling me they did not want this war, and what they did, they voted for. That means they're not listening to the people. So Not in Our Name means we're no longer going to stand by and let them use our name as a country and as a people to use it for their own selfish gains and motivations, whatever they may be. I don't feel in the position to speculate on, but that's what I'm going to say, Not in Our Name. I'm not going to support this war. I'm not going to support the violence of our government. I'm not going to support its criminal actions. I'm going to talk about them as they really are. You know, I'm going to say that just because Americans are holding the guns doesn't mean that our actions aren't terrorism, you know, too. That when we shoot and kill other people, that when we bomb other countries and devastate civilian populations, when we prop up dummy governments and then knock them over, like Saddam Hussein, that serve our interests and we no longer needed him, now they want to cut him out. No longer in our name will we allow the government to do that. No longer in our name will we allow people to suffer, you know, for the benefit of the American people. You know, they say they're doing it for our interests, to support our democracy, to support our freedom. But I don't feel like they're doing that because they're not listening to our voice.
Just before the congressional vote authorizing Bush's use of force, CIA Director George Tenet told lawmakers that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, if provoked by fears of an imminent U.S.-led attack, might assist Islamic extremists in launching an attack against the United States with weapons of mass destruction. You've put all of our lives at much greater risk, and for nothing. I fear that the fact that you led the House in out-of-district donations to your campaign, 99%, makes you less concerned about your constituents. I feel that the fact that the oil and gas industry donated more to your campaign. I feel the fact that the oil and gas industry donated more to your campaign than any other industry shows.
I can barely hear you. Just tell me.
Step
away from the mic.
My question to you is...
Quick question.
My question to you is...
Yeah, I'm going to use the timer. From now on, I'm using the timer. timer. Quickly.
My question is,
just ask me. Come on, quickly.
Stop interrupting me. I'll ask
you. I can't hear you on the microphone, sir. Just tell me.
What can we do to correct this error that you have committed against the people of Iraq and against the people of this country, putting us in great
danger? All right, his question is, he does not want us to go after Saddam Hussein. Sorry, we're taking him out as fast as humanly possible. Keeping time and controlling an unruly mind than you have to control commissioners for.
Why did the vampire stick a gold bite? So it could have three gold.
Very interesting that you call yourself a Jeffersonian Republican when it was Thomas Jefferson who advocated free trade, friendship, and entangling with all nations and entangling alliances with none. Not the foreign reckless foreign policy of the United States.
The
and follow.
Hey,
I will.
Hey,
give me a
three
chance.
Feet. Come on, one at a time. He's got a minute.
Not the reckless foreign policy the United States has been following in the last 50 years that led to 9/11. And in that light, why did you violate the Constitution by voting to initiate an offensive war against Iraq when the Constitution requires a declaration of war and only authorizes that our Defense Department be used to defend our borders? And secondly, what are you doing to repeal the USA Patriot Act that violates the Bill of Rights?
Two questions. Why did I vote for a resolution authorizing the use of force instead of a declaration of war? I asked that question because I actually would have preferred a straight-up declaration of war, and Chairman Henry Hyde of the Judiciary Committee told me that when the United States declares war, it makes any country that's doing business with Iraq an enemy. So the Canadians, the French, anybody else that's got a contract or doing business with Iraq immediately becomes, we have to declare war on Canada.
I am here with, what is your name, sir?
Donald Tatum.
Donald, where are you from originally?
I was born in Houston.
What gives our Congress and the people of our Congress the moral authority to enact any sort of attack on another country, even if they're deemed to be evil, when we have alliances with evil countries?
We have a history of doing the wrong thing a lot more than we have a history of doing the right thing about people in other countries. They end up with dictators that we had supported, and that, in fact, we are the ones that supported Saddam when he went in, and it certainly wasn't the right thing to do.
Thanks to Jackson Allers and Barry Brosa of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Commentators Ralph Schulman and Maya Schoen from Taking Aim Radio at WBAI in New York see links between Bush's war agenda for Iraq and the ongoing violence in the Middle East.
The invasion of Iraq is the first stage in a conquest of the Middle East. Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are next. This is the conclusion of BBC Washington correspondent Tom Carver, who noted that the intellectual underpinning of this vision comes from Paul Wolfowitz, now Deputy Secretary of Defense. It is shared by his boss, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Dick Cheney, and President George Walker Bush.
Maya, you could quote Yogi Berra here. It's deja vu all over again, because this entire policy was prepared in the 1970s when Iraq and the Gulf and Saudi Arabia were quite specifically targeted in the Pentagon and National Security Council for military seizure, describing this in its report as the new El Dorado awaiting its conquistadors. And the detailed plan had actually been prepared by Oded Yinon of the Israeli Mossad and the Department of Information of the World Zionist Organization, calling for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country in turn into their ethnic and religious components. The Oded Yinon plan was very specific. Iraq would be first, described as rich in oil and internally torn. It was guaranteed as the initial target, its dissolution stated to be even more important than that of Syria. They actually called for dissolving Iraq into a number of statelets and provinces along ethnic lines, as Syria was during the Ottoman period. Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, and the Shiite areas in the south, were to be separated from the Sunni and Kurdish north. Then Egypt would be torn apart like a second Lebanon, the report describes. Saudi Arabia next, to be followed by the Emirates in the Gulf.
The Oded Yinon plan was taken up by Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Kenneth Armitage, and the Committee on the Present Danger. The plans were analyzed fully in the late 1978 by the Brookings Institution, with a detailed analysis of the frequency of U.S. military intervention between 1946 and 1975. The Brookings Institution revealed 215 times between 1946 and 1975 in which armed forces were used for specific political objectives. The study concluded, as the Vietnam War fades from the nation's consciousness, international system presents a large number of opportunities.
This has been on the drawing board for a very long time. It shows the real meaning despite all the propaganda about who's responsible for September 11th. With all the current pretexts and propaganda designed to terrorize the American people into numbed acquiescence in permanent war. This is Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen.
Some of the sharpest opposition to attacking Iraq is coming from the church President Bush purportedly attends. Jim Winkler is a layperson responsible for applying the teachings of the United Methodist Church to social policy. In the second of our ongoing series on spiritual responses to the war agenda, Winkler spoke to us about the Christian doctrine of just and unjust wars. We asked him if attacking Saddam Hussein for his alleged actions against the Iraqi people qualifies as a just war.
No, we don't believe it does. When I was working on my statement back in August, I contacted leaders in our church and elsewhere, including seminary professors who are Christian ethicists, and I asked them their opinion on whether or not these historic just war standards had been met by the president. And what I learned was that no, they had not been met. In fact, in late September, 100 leading Christian ethicists adopted a statement opposing a war in Iraq. And it's a one-sentence statement. If I may read it, I think your viewers
yes,
may
please.
Find it interesting. Mm-hmm. It simply says, as Christian ethicists, we share a common moral presumption against a preemptive war on Iraq by the United States. I talked to the professor who organized this effort, Sean Casey, who's professor at Wesley Theological Seminary here in Washington. And Sean told me that he could not find a single Christian ethicist who would support a preemptive war against Iraq. Now, subsequently, the Southern Baptist Convention with Dr. Richard Land, the head of their, I think, Ethics and Public Life Commission, has written a statement which Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson have signed, and they've sent it to the president saying that they have, in fact, found justification for a preemptive war against Iraq. But not only in the United Methodist community, but the Roman Catholic community and most other Christian communions have not found that to be the case. There are a number of standards for a just war that have to be met, and they include things like proportionality, that is, the violence inflicted must be proportional to the injury suffered. A just war can only be waged after all peaceful options are exhausted. In essence, really, a just war theory is a defensive theory, not an offensive theory. And so,
but yet you're saying Jerry Falwell's church has found this to be a just war.
That's right. That's right. And I think, once again, the Southern Baptist Convention falls far, far outside of most Christian thinking in this country, and I think it's unfortunate that they've put themselves in the category essentially of being a war church.
Now, does President Bush profess to be a member of the United Methodist Church?
That's right.
Church?
He does. And so is the vice president.
Mm-hmm. And so has your church attempted to communicate with him about your position other than issuing statements?
Yes. On October 11th, we had a number of bishops here in town to participate in a citizens' hearing at the Rayburn Building, chaired by Congressman Danny Davis of Chicago. And as part of that effort, following that citizens' hearing, I tried to secure a meeting for the bishops with the president. And we received a very polite reply that the president was too busy, and I understand that he's very busy. I tried to impress upon the staff people I spoke to at the White House that these were the bishops of the president's denomination, and they wanted to pray for him, and they wanted to express their concerns about a potential war. They offered us a meeting with a lower-ranking staff person, and we appreciate that, but we really felt that this is an important time in the life of our country, and that it would be preferable for the bishops to have an opportunity to meet with someone in a decision-making role, and we still hope for that opportunity. But so far, we haven't had that chance.
You say that war is incompatible with the Christian teachings, and I would submit that this country professes to be a Judeo-Christian country in that many of the values and doctrines that are adopted come from the Judeo-Christian teachings. Yet war is very much a part of the history of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did... It doesn't seem to balance to me.
Well, I think there's it's just good old-fashioned sin is the key word there, in my opinion, that we're dealing with. And it's always a struggle, I think, not only for Christians, but followers of other faiths who are in decision-making roles, to separate, to reconcile their faith with their responsibilities as citizens and as leaders. Sometimes I think that we tend to wrap the cross in the flag, and it's very tempting for us to do so. Our country is extremely powerful, really the only superpower on the planet, and so when we have these amazing weapons at our disposal, I think sometimes we sometimes fail to remember who Christ is and what he is about. And everything that I understand about Jesus is against hate, revenge, violence, and war, and really is about ushering in a new time of forgiveness, peace, justice, and reconciliation. So I have occasionally pastors or lay people who will write to me and say Jesus did in fact support violence and war, that Jesus was not one who submitted to military domination or violence in a submissive manner. And I agree, he did not. I think Jesus really taught strategic, nonviolent civil disobedience. In fact, I think Gandhi and Martin Luther King learned a lot about effective tactics of resistance against domination systems from the teachings of Christ. We sometimes tend to forget that since Constantine turned Christian in the 300s and the church went from being a sort of an opposition movement to being the church of the state, and we need to recover our roots.
What should Americans who happen to follow the Christian teachings of the United Methodist Church be doing about this impending war on Iraq? In addition to any socially political action that they might be taking, is there prayer work that Americans should be doing? Should they be praying for Saddam Hussein?
Oh, absolutely. And for George Bush, for everyone involved in an impending war, as well as for those who might suffer from it. But I think more than praying is required here. That's a key part, and it's a beginning point for us as Christians. But I think there's at least six things that could be considered. And I take these from the Quakers, the Friends Committee for National Legislation. First, I think that our country should stop threatening to violently overthrow Saddam Hussein. Second, I think we should resume direct negotiations with Iraq. Third, we need to demilitarize the conflict with Iraq. The constant bombings that we've been carrying on for all these years against Iraq have led to a situation where many in Iraq believe our country to be a hostile enemy, and I think they've diminished our standing in the Muslim and Arab world generally. Fourth, I think we need to end the inhumane economic sanctions immediately. Fifth, we need to continue the current embargo on the sale and transfer of military equipment to Iraq and widen that to the entire region. And sixth, we need to continue to press Iraq to accept UN weapons inspections and monitoring. I think that's a positive, nonviolent alternative to war that should be pursued immediately. I think it would mean a significant change in our nation's policies, but I believe that it would be consistent with the ideals of our country and with not only Christian faith, but I think really consistent with faith of Jews and Muslims and others in our country. And I pray that we'll turn away from the course of war and toward a more peaceful means to resolve this conflict.
Jim Winkler is General Secretary of the General Board of Church and Society of the United Methodist Church. Yesterday, we heard a Muslim perspective on the war agenda. Tomorrow, a noted rabbi will be our guest.
Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurdish people, killed thousands in a single day. And 12 long years later, Uncle Sam said you can't treat Kurds this way. Furthermore, all Kurds are freedom fighters who'd resist this Iraqi tyranny. And Uncle Sam will give them guns and maybe sometimes ammunition so the brave Kurds can fight until they're free. Meanwhile, in southeastern Turkey, the Turkish army had a unique plan. We'll go burn down 3,000 villages, get rid of what they call Kurdistan. Well, some of these pesky Kurds decided that they would rather fight instead of die. So Uncle Sam said, you are terrorists because Turkey is our ally. Geopolitics is confusing. In fact, it can be quite absurd. Especially if you value your freedom. You live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when Iraqi Kurds are massacred, we say this is genocide. Okay, we armed the army through the 80s, but now we proudly take the Kurdish side. But in Turkey, it's an internal matter.
David Rovick's Good Kurds, Bad Kurds. The history of the peace movement in this country is rich in hardworking heroes and sheroes. Father Richard McSorley is one such person. In this next segment, Independent Media Center activist Jinka honors the work and contribution of Father McSorley.
What can I do for peace? That's a question I'm sure that all of us are concerned about in this nuclear age. One of the things that we can do is to try to understand the world we're in and what peace means in this nuclear age.
Father McSorley was an advocate for peace and against war his entire life. A prisoner of war in the Philippines during World War II, Father McSorley was very active in the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement, as well as local Washington, D.C. struggles for housing, health care, and home rule. Among his students and friends were Bill Clinton, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., Mitch Snyder, and Dorothy Day. His activism continued through the 80s and 90s with the anti-nuclear movement, and most recently in the strong stance he took against the first Gulf War in the early 90s, against the U.S. attack on Afghanistan last fall, and against the current threatened attack on Iraq. Father McSorley speaking in the 1980s against war.
Peace is that reconciliation between myself, my God, and my neighbor. It's whatever unites me with my human neighbor and my God. Whatever brings all three of us together, God, myself, and my neighbor. Friendship, marriage, community, faith, all of this is peacemaking. Peace is based on trust, and it leads to love. War is whatever divides us. Whatever divides us from God and from each other. Racism, excessive nationalism, oppression of the poor. War is nourished by hatred, and it leads to death.
Services for Father Richard McSorley will be held Tuesday, October 22nd, in Washington, D.C., at the Trinity Church at 36th and O Streets, Northwest, at 8 o'clock p.m. May the burgeoning peace movement in this country follow the example of the life of Father Richard McSorley in their work for peace in this nuclear age. This is Jenka from the Independent Media Center in Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Granger Helvey. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK, Renee Feltz of KPFT, and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Binsky are consultants to the program. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA and Laurel Padgett-Seekins at WPFW. Our webmaster is Pete Caracas. For copies of Peace Watch, go to www.pacificaarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your feedback on the show. Send us your comments to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.